This is In Focus, the weekly public affairs program from KTBB and the Team Sports Radio, featuring members of the local community working to make East Texas a better place.
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to In Focus. I'm Roger Gray, and this is going to be fun. I now know to call him Nate. We have Congressman Nathaniel Moran with us here to talk about the big budget bill that was passed and signed and into law. Lots of detractors out there, some controversy, lots of defenders. We'll kind of dig into it a little bit. First of all, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Roger. It's great to be here, and I'm appreciative of the fact that we can have a conversation that's more than just 30 seconds, because this is not a 30-second bill.
No.
This is a bill that took Republicans primarily about a year and a half, really, to craft, and I'd been working heavy on it, really, for about 8 months since I knew I was going to be on Ways and Means, and then while I was on Ways and Means Committee this year. And so there's a lot to unpack in this bill, and there's a lot to go through.
Well, let's do some of it. Let's go easy before I ambush it. Let's talk about the good stuff. So I was reading one business publication this week, and it talked about some of the items that they're not as glamorous, they don't get as much publicity, but work well for business, that are good items to encourage business activity, growth, hiring, et cetera, et cetera. Can you talk about some of that?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that, because that's where the core of this bill started. This was really the foundation of the need to pass a reconciliation package, because you had 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act provisions related to both families and businesses that were going to fall off, that were going to expire, and some had already expired. And as a result of that, we had gotten tons of feedback from small and medium-sized businesses and large businesses across America that said, look, we're holding on to our capital. We're not releasing our capital. We're not making long-term research and development decisions, and we won't unless we have some surety and some certainty about the tax bill going forward and whether or not these tax provisions are going to be friendly towards that.
Right.
And that's what we intended to start out with, was how can we open up the economy for our small and medium and large sized businesses and our families, and we'll get to those as well. Let me just hit at some top line provisions.
Okay.
One of which is R&D expensing. So R&D expensing.
Research and development.
Research and development. Yeah. You know, that's a big deal for companies, and we're one of like two countries in the world that was not allowing companies to have immediate expensing in a lot of different areas. R&D was one of them. So we wanted to make sure that they could take a full expense in the year that they took it off their income taxes to say, all right, we spent all this in R&D, let's expense it out in the same year instead of spreading it out over 5 years.
Yeah.
Same thing with equipment purchases. That's another capital expenditure. There had been a decline since a couple of years ago of how much businesses could begin to deduct. We were losing that bonus depreciation, and so we restored that to 100% so that if you had a capital expenditure, then you could take it. Now it's back up to 100%. Then you had this qualified business interest deduction expense, Section 199, Section 199A for small businesses. 90+% of the businesses in Congressional District 1 are pass-through entities. It's LLCs, it's partnerships, it's going to be S corporations that utilize an individual income tax return to file their income taxes.
They're not filing corporate taxes.
That's right. They're not filing corporate taxes. So think about the C corporations are really the big corporations. That would have been the other 8, 9, 10% of the corporations in this world.
GM and
that's
that,
right.
that sort of thing.
And so everybody under 2017 was enjoying kind of this low 20s tax rate. But in order to get there for small businesses, the pass-through entities, there had to be this Section 199 provision that allowed them to deduct some of that income. Well, this was going to fall off, and that was going to make the effective rate for these businesses go from about 21 or 22% up to about 43% in 1 year. And I had a pass-through business when I was a business owner, and most of East Texans do. Those are small businesses and families that are taking home that.
I was a partner in a radio station in Houston.
And so seeing a double taxation for those businesses overnight would make it almost impossible for those businesses to grow. So now you got the bonus depreciation. You're adding back in the DAW for the interest deduction expense. Instead of just the EBIT, you get the whole EBIT DAW and the whole full 20%.
And by the way, nobody out there knows what you just said.
I know. That's the complicating thing about this is you get these top line things out there that are being discussed on media. But the core of this, as you know, was really a business proposition and a family proposition to say, let's keep taxes low on businesses and families, both. Let them have more freedom, more liberty back, and more decision-making. Let their hard work and their sweat equity determine their future. And that's really what this bill started out with. But we had 11 different committees that were involved in this. So I've just talked about some of the Ways and Means Committee activity.
What's the old line about too many cooks? Qualified structures, for example.
That's right.
Those can be expensed now, you know, your building and so forth.
Yeah, the Made in America manufacturing provisions is a new provision. So if you're going to do domestic production and you want to use a new facility and build that new facility, or you want to rehab an old facility, you can expense 100% of that now.
Yeah.
So that's going to take a lot of the capital that's sitting on the shelf right now. And businesses have told me this.
Mm-hmm.
Now that that's out there, they're going to go out there and they're going to reinvest in capital expenditures like equipment, R&D. They're going to start making more production facilities. And as a result of that, more jobs out there and growth in the revenue. This is where it gets to be a little bit of a conversation across the aisle, is I happen to believe that when you do that and you grow businesses, that even though the tax rates remain low, the revenue goes up to the federal government because you're expanding the income coming in from these businesses. Mm-hmm. And that is actually what's happening.
Okay, let's talk about debt, which is the first thing I have to confess bugged me about it. This is going to add to the debt. Just to put this in perspective, the last time we had a budget surplus was 2001. The last four of the Clinton administration were in surplus. He had a lot of help on that, no doubt about it. President and Congress worked together. The national debt in 2001 was $5.8 trillion. Now we're at 36, almost 37. And there have been a few things in between there, you know, the pandemic and the recession and the war on terror and all of that. And those cost money. But it's gotten huge.
Yeah, it has gotten huge, and it's out of hand, and it's not a result of just Democratic policies or just Republican policies. Frankly, both parties...
It's a joint project.
It is. Both parties deserve equal blame because we've spent money in equal portions just on different things.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has to be this reining in of spending, no question about it, to get out of the debt situation. We've got to grow our economy on one side, and we've got to reduce spending on the other side. It's the easy equation.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at this bill, and I'll go through some of the numbers on the deficit that may come as a result of this bill and some of the foundations behind that and how the math works behind that. But at base, when I looked at this bill and the choice of if I was just looking at this on a deficit and a debt issue, I'm looking at it going, okay, I can either not pass something and not pass this bill, and we will see tax rates go up. We will see the economy shrink, in my opinion. We will see revenues go down, in my opinion. And we will still be saddled with the same mandatory spending programs that we have out there that's growing the debt in a large way. What this bill does is it reduces some of those mandatory spending programs probably by about $1 trillion or more a year, depending on which numbers you're looking at. Not as much as we need to. We've got to restrain that spending more. But quite frankly, you saw how difficult it was to get people to vote for more spending cuts, and we need more spending cuts, absolutely. But then we would also be saddled with, if we didn't pass this bill, we'd be saddled with a smaller economy. So you'd have less revenues going in. So the greater result would be, if we didn't pass this bill, more debt and deficit than any of the numbers that I'm seeing coming out as a result of what people think might happen in this bill.
The debt is going to go up, though, with or without this bill.
That's right.
The debt's going to go up. As a matter of fact, the CBO says, where's the actual debt figure? The CBO says that by 2034, we're going to be looking at $59 trillion.
I hope not.
But that's because we're paying interest and deficits every year.
Yeah.
And deficits used to be in the billions, and now they're in the trillions.
Yeah, more than $2 trillion a year in deficit every year. And what you're seeing is almost $1 trillion now in interest payments, which is more than what our military gets per year, which is unsustainable. And the greater our debt grows, the greater the interest rate. And if we don't get our debt under control, then you know that you're probably going to see the bond markets respond with higher interest rates, which then grows.
We've already been downgraded by the last one that had us at number one, at A1.
Yeah. So then the question becomes, all right, where are we going to cut the spending and enough to get back to a balanced budget? More than 70% of our budget is tied up in mandatory spending programs that don't go through the annual appropriations process. And then you're left with those 12 appropriations bills that comprise that other 25 or so percent of our budget. But if you extract out defense and veterans, you're only left with about 11% of the federal budget. So even if you cut out all of that, which most people, I think, would look at that other 11% and say, actually, that's the 11%. Most of it is what we need. Even if you cut all that out, you're still not reducing it enough to
there's
get
not
to
enough there
it.
To cut. If you,
right.
if you leave defense off the table, for example, there's not enough to cut.
That's right. So you actually have to look at the mandatory spending programs. Mm-hmm. If you don't, you never get enough cuts in spending. But, Roger, here's the dirty little secret. Mm-hmm. Everybody says you need to cut spending. Government needs to cut spending. And the moment government tries to cut spending, mm-hmm. they're like, whoa, but don't cut the spending that's coming to me.
Well, yeah.
And then the response is, well, then what spending do you want me to cut? Mm-hmm. Because there's so much government spending and so many government ties to our everyday lives now that unless we are willing to see some of those ties get cut, we will never see enough spending cuts to get us back to a balanced budget. I think we need to go through that painful process and cut enough spending, mm-hmm. return mm-hmm. those dollars back to families and businesses so they can decide where their money goes, not government.
All right, but as two guys who have owned businesses, there are a couple of things you can do when you find yourself heading into red ink. You can cut your costs or you can increase your revenue.
Yeah.
There is an argument. Is this cut, this tax cut, worth the pain it's going to inflict debt-wise? If you look at the lowest income, 20% of households in this country, they're going to get about $160 out of this. And if they lose Medicaid, if they lose SNAP, it goes down to like $50, $60. The next quarter, the middle income households, they're getting about $1,800, about 2.4%. And I'm not sitting here making the argument about, oh, the rich are getting all the cuts, because they pay more taxes. They have more money. But is that small a gift back worth all the debt that's going to accumulate?
Well, first of all, I disagree with the assumption that having higher tax rates would bring in more revenue. I disagree with that. I happen to think that at this point...
That's what we use.
No.
That's how we get revenue.
But there's a... You know the Laffer curve. I mean, we can...
Yeah, and it doesn't work.
It does work. And you look back at JFK. JFK even took this conservative view as well because he reduced those high tax rates.
You know how high they were back then?
They were 90%. I know.
Yes.
I know, they were. And then Reagan followed the same suit, but if you
and they didn't pay for themselves. But David Stockman proved that to Reagan.
But if you look back at what happened in the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and you look at the statistics after that, you see enormous growth in revenues at the federal level.
But they don't pay for themselves, and they do. No, they don't. They never have.
And when you see the revenue that comes into the federal government after 2017 and 18 and 19, the extraordinary growth before we hit the pandemic, which was unexpected, the problem was not revenue, it was spending. That was our problem back then, and that remains
well, the
our
pandemic
problem.
Is why you spend.
Well,
I mean, things like pandemics and wars and recessions, that's when the spending goes up.
But then consider this, because a lot of the things that we're getting pushback on right now is the cuts to spending to return them to pre-pandemic marks.
Mm-hmm.
And people are saying, oh my goodness, I can't believe you're cutting that program. And I would say, you realize that program didn't come around until the pandemic, and it was a reaction to the pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
So why are we keeping it beyond that?
And that makes perfect sense.
But those are the arguments right there. And when we look at even the Medicaid arguments mm-hmm. about the things that we're doing to Medicaid, mm-hmm. you're like, you know, you realize almost 75 million people, a quarter of our population mm-hmm. is on Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that, like 20 plus million of those folks, came on after the Affordable Care Act was passed. Mm-hmm. There's about 23 million able-bodied adults that are on Medicaid. And you want to say, look, we don't want to impact Medicaid for the core group that need them, the kids, mm-hmm. the mothers with young children, the seniors. We do not want to do that. The folks that need that safety net. Mm-hmm. But for people that are able-bodied adults that are just sitting at home for long periods of time.
Now, why are you assuming they're all sitting at home? Because most of the people on Medicaid work.
Oh, but
most of the people who can work are working. They just don't make much money.
What I'm addressing is the pushback on the number of people that we are being accused of cutting off the rolls of Medicaid going forward. And quite clearly, the only people that are going to be cut out are folks that won't meet a small, moderate work threshold. And that's it. And you can volunteer. You can go to school. You can go to work 20 hours a week, and you're good. And you can be on Medicaid. But if you can't meet those requirements and you don't otherwise meet an exemption, some of those exemptions I just mentioned, if you're disabled or if you're with a mother with a child under 14 or if you're a senior, those kinds of folks, they don't have to meet those requirements. But if you're an able-bodied adult and you're not in one of those exempt categories, why can't you get out and do that?
Well, no reason you can't, but most of them do work.
But we're talking about the people that we're being accused of throwing off the Medicaid rolls. And so those are the only people that are going to be off the rolls that aren't currently accepted, unless you are also, here's the other category, folks, if you're here illegally, or if you are, and they're receiving...
You can't qualify for receiving government programs.
But they're receiving them indirectly. And that's where...
Because hospitals can't turn them away.
And that's where a lot of that...
Well, that's the law, though. They can't turn somebody away.
But they can no longer access Medicaid funds under this bill to indirectly provide those services to folks that are here illegally. And states are now...
You're talking about the hospitals can't.
Yeah. Okay. And so... and then there's a category of folks that are out there that have actually set up to get Medicaid benefits in two states. I know that's hard for folks to believe, but they do that, and that's called fraud.
Well, yeah.
And so we're going to clean some of those rolls, but guess what? There's like a million point two people out there that are doing that. We're going to be accused of kicking 1.2 million people off, and the Democrats will not explain to folks, well, those are people that were actually getting benefits in two states. And they also will see a number of non-eligible individuals that are going to get cleaned off the rolls. Why? Because now we're going to check the rolls twice a year. And that makes sense. If you're not eligible, you shouldn't be getting that program. But under the Biden administration, they quit checking those rolls because they could care less. They want everybody on there. That's the Democrats' view, is they want universal provision of this benefit to anybody. And that's not what it was intended for. It was a safety net program. And we want to preserve that safety net program, but it can't be for everybody under any circumstance.
Okay. But you have there are people who are going to lose their benefits. Understood.
Yeah. I've made no secret of that, and I've talked about that. I think.
I mean, you've already cut $1 trillion for the next 10 years. So
yeah.
Somebody has to go.
It's the people that won't meet the small work requirements, or that are indirectly receiving these benefits through hospitals that shouldn't because they're illegal, or that are not eligible to begin with. They're going to clean off the rolls.
Explain to me, if you would, how they get indirect benefits.
I don't know the technicalities of it, but I know that there's a number, and you can talk to the hospitals about that, but there's a number of folks that receive those benefits.
Another of the concerns, though, is hospitals, particularly small ones, rural hospitals. They depend a lot on Medicaid, and there is a concern out there that those hospitals are going to have to go under.
Well, we worked hard with our hospitals here to understand what we needed to make sure to do to preserve rural health. That's really important to us. We spent a lot of time talking to our hospitals about that situation, and I recognize that there is going to be a decrease in revenue, certainly, as a result of what we've done. But again, if you can't cut in this area, where can you cut?
Mm-hmm.
Really, I mean, where are you going to cut, Roger? And I could. And I could ask you that question, where would you like for the federal government to cut? And so I know that in the Senate they put aside several tens of billions of dollars for rural health in particular, trying to make up this gap. We're hopeful that provides the padding that's needed. There's a number of other things that hospitals do to make sure that rural health is out there. The local provider participation fund is one way. The The 1115 waiver program is another as well. The 340B drug pricing program that's out there. Those are some of the really big portions of revenue that end up supporting our rural hospital systems. We want to make sure that our hospital systems still are able to provide in the rural area. It's important to us as a rural district.
There is a premium support portion of the ACA that a lot of rural hospitals depend on. I interviewed somebody from the Rural Health Association talking about that they really hate to see that go away, because a lot of hospitals are depending on that, particularly out in the country where you don't have a lot of people and those people don't have a lot of money.
Yeah, there's a lot with our system that's set up presently across the United States that the federal government really has screwed up the free market of healthcare. And no question, as you start to adjust it, there's going to be an adjustment period, because there is not an ability to sustain the federal government supporting every hospital system in the United States the way it has. There's just no way for it to do that. Now, I'm hopeful that they can, and I'm certain that they will be able to shift. They're going to have to make business decisions like you and I did about how and when they spend their money and where they spend their money. No question about that. Yeah. And I have no doubt that our hospital systems will do that. But when the federal government provides so much pork and fat to any industry, and we could talk about a number of industries that are out there where that's happened over time, those industries love it. Yeah, they love it. And they don't want any of it to go away. Mm-hmm. Guess what? Mm-hmm. It's not sustainable. Back to your point about the overall deficit and debt that we have. Okay. So really, do we need to be providing every single ounce of all this support to all of these hospital systems around the United States? Is there a better way for the free market to work itself out so that consumers that show up to a healthcare system actually understand what they're going to pay, they make a choice on what they're going to pay, instead of where we're headed, and that is where the consumer doesn't care because they're not going to pay it anyway, right? They're not going to see a bill that it's going to somehow get paid by somebody else. Well, that somebody else is the taxpayer. And at the end of the day, we can't allow that to be the case. Otherwise, everybody will go get everything they want at any time, or think they want at any time, without having to work through a value proposition about whether or not it's worth it for them to pay that amount of money for a particular service.
But those services are incredibly expensive now. Medical cost increases are unsustainable if you're in the lower income area.
Well, I would say that there's a whole lot of opportunity for folks to receive the medical care that they need. If they are low income and are eligible for Medicaid benefits currently, and they meet these work requirements, if they are trying to do the things that you and I would think is the kind of the customary reasonable approach, they're going to be qualified for these things, and they're going to have the services available to them. It's the folks that believe that they deserve it, whether or not they are willing to engage in any beneficial output to society. Those are the folks.
Do you have any idea how many of those people there are on Medicaid right now?
Well, I know that, like I said, there's about 23 million able-bodied adults on Medicaid right now. That's one of the numbers I have out there. And we're told by estimates.
But most of them are working.
We're told that about 4.5 million on estimate, and from a bunch of different folks. Okay. About 4.5 million of those will likely choose not to meet the work requirements.
Okay. All right. And I think most people would find that reasonable.
I think so, too. Yeah. I mean, it's not hard. The work requirements are not tough.
Yeah. Okay. How about SNAP?
Yeah.
The cuts to SNAP.
Yeah, so
these are what used to be called food stamps.
Yeah, that's right. So when we're talking about SNAP, the one thing to remember about this is, again, there's just some work requirements on there that are easy kind of work requirements that look a lot like the Medicaid work requirements. Mm-hmm. But exemptions from the work requirements, those under 18 or over 65. So none of those folks are going to lose SNAP benefits. Pregnant women, parents and caretakers of kids under 14, individuals that are certified as physically or mentally unfit, so the disabled, all of those folks are exempt from the work requirements. None of those folks should lose any of their SNAP benefits. The other thing that's happening with SNAP is...
But you guys have cut it by about 30%.
There's a 5% cut. I don't know where you're getting the 30% number. There's a 5% cut that happens at base, and it could go up depending on the types of the number by state of improper payments that are made. And then there's a shifting of some of the financial burden to some of the states. And this is, I have no problem with this, of shifting the burden, because if states are giving improper payments, and I think Texas has...
Texas is a rich state, but not every state is.
Well, they're
Maine, for example, is not a rich state.
They're not, but I mean, those are... Now you're talking about outlier situations, but where the biggest problem is states like, I mean, New York or California or folks that they really have no desire to ensure correct eligibility or correct payments, and there's no incentive for them to do that. Why? Because they're getting a blank check from the federal government. They're going to get this money regardless, and the federal government's not going to check that. Well, that's no longer going to be the situation. If you're going to receive this money as a state, the state has to do a good job to make sure their improper payments are kept low. Mm-hmm. But the other thing to mention about this the SNAP benefits is this 5% kind of at base cut for each state is doesn't go into effect except for 2 years. It starts in 2 years. And so it's not like tomorrow. So it's not like tomorrow these cuts are going to go away. So if you start hearing next month somebody lost their SNAP benefits as a result of this, I'm going to tell you that's not true.
But I'm getting emails from the local food bank saying SNAP has been cut. We're going to have a tough time providing food for everybody.
Yeah, I saw that press release as well, and I love the food bank. We've worked with them for years. When I was a county judge, we did a lot to help out over there as well. And it's something my kids and my wife have volunteered with before, and we've done some things with them before. And so, boy, it's a really wonderful, really wonderful ministry, and they do a lot of great stuff. And so my hope is that that we are able to continue some of the services at the same level. But again, back to is it government's full responsibility to provide all of this to them? There's a couple of grants that they're losing that are USDA grants. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen in the One Big Beautiful Bill. That happened in the executive action. And, you know, I'm kind of sorry that went away overnight. I think entities need to have time to figure out what they're going to do to backfill, to adjust. Absolutely. I think that's the way to work through that situation. But that wasn't my call. But nevertheless, let's look at those two programs. Those two programs were COVID-era programs that started. So if you say, well, again, we had lots of spending in COVID-era, we're going back to pre-COVID era. And then you go back to the philosophy of, well, whose responsibility is this? I would rather give Roger Gray back the money. And you were talking about the amount of money people are going to save. The average East Texan making $61,000, I think the last figure I saw was about $1,200 that they would save in taxes next year. I would rather give back that money to East Texans and for them to be able to say, you know what, I think the East Texas Food Bank is worthy. I'd like to send them some of that money, as opposed to federal government deciding who gets all that money. Mm-hmm. Because when the federal government steps in, now all of a sudden, Washington, D.C., I can tell you they do not align with the social values of every district in the United States. And so even if they pick all the ones we like, folks in California can be like, how come you didn't pick the entities that we like to send money to? Yeah. And oftentimes, the places that the federal government picks to send money is different than what we want in East Texas. I would rather businesses and individuals have that money back in their pocket, and they decide which nonprofits to support. The federal government is not the nonprofit support foundation.
Okay. Last question about energy. What do you guys have against renewable energy? Now, renewables provide 30% of ERCOT's energy.
Yeah.
Why are we, as a matter of fact, we're the tops in the country in renewable energy.
We don't have anything against renewable energy. The thing we have against any subsidized form of energy that is, if you can't sustain yourself and you cannot make it in a free market, then you shouldn't be perpetually supported by the federal government.
You mean like the $20 billion we give to oil and gas every year?
Well, I'm just telling you, I think across the board, you would find conservatives like me say, I think that none of them should get it.
Exxon will do fine.
Yeah. Exxon will do fine. Exxon absolutely will do fine. And so, we don't want to see some of those businesses that invested based on the decisions we made back in 2017 have the rug pulled out from under them. I think that's why you see a wind down on this, because some have already made investments based on what they relied on the federal government on. But that having been said, at some point, you either got to be viable in the market or you don't on your own, and the federal government can't keep supporting that.
And we're going to have to let it go at that.
Oh, Roger, I'm so sorry. We didn't hardly get to anything.
You came in with a computer ready to go. Nathaniel Moran, thank you so much. I appreciate you standing up to all this abuse. And
My pleasure, Roger. It's always great to be with you, and thanks for what you do.
Thank you. And we will see you guys next week.
In Focus is a weekly public affairs program featuring members of the local community working to make East Texas a better place. In Focus is produced by KTBB and the Team Sports Radio. And we thank you for listening. Join us again next week.